Good evening. My name's Deb. I'm a real alcoholic.
Hi.
It is really an honor and a privilege to be with you tonight. Thank you, Randy, for asking me to come here and being a great host to myself, my husband, and my mom tonight. My sobriety date is March 15th, 1987. And I was speaking at the Louisiana State Convention, I don't know, 3 years ago, right? Well, maybe 5 years ago. Anyway, I was speaking at the Louisiana State Convention, and in the thank the speaker line after the meeting, there was a guy who came up, and he had white hair, and he'd been sober 43 years, and he introduced himself like that. He said, "I've been sober 43 years, and he said, "I want you to know that you told us how old you were, and you told us when you got sober, and I did the math." He said, "And I figured out you got sober at 15. He said, "And I decided I was going to quit listening." And I was thinking to myself, dude, this is the thank the speaker line. You know, you really don't have to be in it. It's voluntary. And he said, "Well," he said, "you know," he said, "you're a real alcoholic." I said, "Yes, sir." And he says, "Well," he said, "God decided I needed to hear what you had to say, so he opened my ears against my will." And I said, "Well, was it good for you?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "I'll tell you what," he said, "I'm going to quit ignoring them young people in my home group. I'm going to go home, pick me out one, and sponsor him." Which I thought was just great, you know, because I spent most, even today, I will run into people from time to time, and they'll say, "You got sober at 15 years old," and I'll say, "Yes, I did," and they'll say, "You know, are you sure you're alcoholic?" And I'm like, "Well, have a seat, and we'll talk a little bit, and you can decide for yourselves." You know, I am so incredibly grateful to be a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I am more grateful that I was given the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to apply to my life so that I could have a spiritual awakening that brought about long-term recovery for me. You know, the fellowship brings me the joy in the fellowship, you know, with other folks that I just absolutely dearly love. But on those days when I can't be with you, it is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that sustains me. It's the relationship it has given me with a loving God that makes life worth living today. And, you know, it takes both of those things working together to give us long-term recovery. And so I talk about setting the bar high. I mean, my goodness, were you here for the 10-minute speaker? I mean, Richard just knocked it out of the park. Thank you so much. You know, I got here tonight and some stuff was going on with work, and so my head was completely somewhere else. And Richard got up here and he talked for 10 minutes and it just absolutely brought me back home. You know, what I know to be true today is that I am uniquely qualified to save the lives of other alcoholics because mine has been saved by other alcoholics. And speaking at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the things that I get to do, even though it's probably one of my least favorite things to do. And so I'm going to tell you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened to me, and a little bit about what it's like today. And I don't know what stories I'm going to tell you. I prayed before I got up here, so it's really not in my hands. And I don't know who needs to hear what. You know, I was speaking at another big meeting once, and I was talking, and you know, sometimes my mouth is moving, and I'm talking, and I have no idea what I'm really saying. And all I knew was that I was staying, and I was drunk for a long time during my story. You know, and I had that moment where I was saying to myself in my head, "For the love of God, get sober. You know, you've been sober for X amount of years. You got a lot to talk about. Wrap up this drinking stuff and move on." And so I'm having that conversation with myself in my head while I'm telling my story. And after the meeting, once again in the thank the speaker line, at the end of the line, there were these three very young girls who came up. One was in her late teens, and two were in their very early 20s, and they were collectively crying. And they said, "You know, last night we all sat down and had a cup of coffee, and we were trying to decide whether or not we were going to stay in AA or go get drunk together. And we didn't know if we belonged here, and we didn't know if we were alcoholic. And now we know that we're right where we need to be." And I said, "That's why I was drunk so long." You know, that was it. So, you know, I don't get to choose what I talk about. I really don't. I was born and raised in a small town right outside of Akron, Ohio. And in the little town where I lived, all of the families in that little town, they all came out of the hills of West Virginia or the hills of Pennsylvania when the coal mines started shutting down. So I'm really a little bit of a displaced hillbilly. And all of my dad and all of my friends' parents, they all worked hard and they drank hard. And as long as you got up and answered the bell the next morning, everything was fine. You know, as long as you brought home a paycheck, all was well. And for me and my family, my dad was an alcoholic, and he's an alcoholic today. He has cirrhosis of the liver. He has Alzheimer's disease that they believe is early onset because of the organic damage done to his brain from alcohol. So I can call my father an alcoholic. And you know, my life when I was a little kid, I was absolutely terrified every single day. I was terrified. I would walk around for the first 9 years of my life, and my little hands were balled up in fists. People talk about that when they talk about who I was when I was little. And I was always in charge, no matter what was going on. If there were little people my size, I was in charge of the entire crew. My hands were balled up in fists, and I was terrified, and I was ready for battle. Because I knew that being scared wasn't okay, but being angry was. You know, those are the kinds of things that I learned in my house. And so I walked around, and I was scared, but I was ready to go. You know, you just bring it on. And that's the way I did life. And I didn't know that that was abnormal. I didn't know that, you know, I wasn't happy and other kids were. I just didn't know that there were any differences. And when I was 9 years old, what I knew about alcohol was this. My dad drank a lot of it. It was incredibly important to him. It was incredibly important to my mother that he not drink a lot of it. And it caused all of the chaos in my house. And when I would ask questions about, you know, why do you drink that stuff? Why is that stuff so important? Oh, do you have to bring that stuff in the house tonight? Anything like that, they would say, shut up, you're a kid. This is adult stuff. And that's all I was ever told about alcohol. But, you know, I knew, intuitively I knew that alcohol was at the center of everything that was going on. And alcohol was at the center of why my hands were in fists. And I didn't know all of that cognitively. You can't put that together when you're nine, but I knew that. And so one of my little girlfriends, her name was Tammy. Her family had a full bar in their basement, and I went there to spend the night like I did most weekends. And we talked her mom into letting us sleep in that bar, and I convinced her that we needed to figure out what this alcohol stuff was, because I was asking questions and nobody was giving me straight answers. And I'm still a little like that today. If I ask you a question, give me a straight answer, because I'm going to take the hard road to find out if you don't answer me. And that was a night of firsts for me. It was my first drink. My first drunk, my first blackout, the next day was my first hangover. I hit the ground running, and I did not stop. You know, we started just picking bottles off the bar based on how cute the labels were. You know, the first one I picked was Christian Brothers because there was a little pilgrim on the label. I said for years that it was bourbon. I was corrected by a nun in the program, and she said, honey, that's brandy. She was sitting out in the middle of an audience when she said that, and I said, thank you very much. So my first drink was brandy out of a Christian Brothers bottle right off the bar, drank out of the neck, didn't know you're supposed to use glasses, and on it went. And I never really had an affinity for glasses. The neck of the bottle was fine for me. And that night kind of set the precedent for me, because the next morning when I came to, it was a little weird that there were things that had happened that I didn't remember. And I was not happy with the fact that I was very, very sick. But that night, there was something magical that happened. You know, if we didn't love what alcohol did to us, we wouldn't continue to drink it, you know, back in the days when we had a choice. You know, these were the days when I had a choice, and I made the decision because of the way alcohol made me feel that I was going to drink as much of this stuff as often as I could. Because that night, my little hands that were balled up in fists, they relaxed. My shoulders that were permanently plugged up here to my ears, they came down. And I exhaled for the first time. I absolutely loved the effect that alcohol had on me. I loved it. The only thing I hated was the fact that that feeling was temporary. It did everything for me that I needed it to do. I didn't know that I had a problem and that I was looking for a solution. I did not know that until I found the solution and then I realized what a problem I had had. But I decided that I wasn't ever going to go a day without alcohol if I could help it. And so that's kind of the way I set out to drink. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know I was going to drink my way into it. I didn't know I was predisposed to alcoholism because my dad was alcoholic. I had none of that information. The only information that I had was that when I put alcohol in my system, it fixed what was wrong with me. And so I decided I was going to do that as often as I could. And that was it. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and they asked me if I was able to control my drinking, I really didn't know the answer to that because I was full steam ahead all the time. You know, the idea of having a couple of drinks and stopping, it just didn't make any sense to me. Why would I do that? Because it didn't take very long where a couple of drinks didn't give me any relief. And I was drinking for relief. And if I didn't get any relief, I was going to keep going. Unfortunately for me, the line for relief and the line for oblivion were very, very close together most of the time. And that was an issue. That was a huge issue. Because when I was in oblivion, I wasn't able to control what I was up to or the consequences and the things that were happening around me. And that's where alcohol and I ran into a problem. You know, I only drank alcohol for 6 years. But I can tell you that the last 6 to 9 months of my drinking, it's all a little fuzzy. I was drinking absolutely every day. And I wasn't drinking just a couple of drinks every day. I was drinking every single day to the point of oblivion. When I would come to in the morning, it would take inside of 2 hours before I would start to shake. And if I didn't get a little something to drink to take the edge off, I was an absolute wreck by lunch. And you cannot sit and go through full-blown withdrawal in study hall. It just doesn't go over very well. But at the same time that I was drinking to the point of oblivion every day and experiencing consequences the likes of which I never, ever knew existed, I was also president of my class. I had straight A's. I was playing 3 varsity sports. I was being scouted for a volleyball scholarship. And I was the girl that every mother wanted her son to date. And I was absolutely hammered out of my mind and unable to control my behavior, the behavior of those around me, every single night. You know, I became physically addicted to alcohol. Mentally, I loved alcohol from the very first moment. I absolutely adored this stuff. And when it reached a point with me about a year out from my stopping drinking where I wanted to not drink so much, I never wanted to stop, but I thought maybe if I could just not drink so much that it would be okay. I was willing to settle for just a little bit of relief if I could avoid all the problems. But I kept trying to shoot for this mark, and I kept blowing right past it. And I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand why that was true for me. I didn't understand why I couldn't just drink a half a fifth. You know, why did I have to keep rolling? You know, I really thought if I could just back it off to that point, I'd be all right. And there was this dark little house on the wrong side of the tracks, and I found these people because we find these people when we need these people. And some of you guys came from that house, and some of you were those people. And I found these people in this house, and it was the place where there was always a bottle sitting on the counter waiting for me. It was the house where there were people who didn't ask how old I was. They knew, but they didn't want me to say it out loud. And it was the house where things were happening to me and around me that I absolutely never knew could happen to somebody. And it was the house where every time I came to and every time I was sober, the parade of the memories and reliving the things that had gone on would start. And I couldn't put up with what was going on in my head because I didn't know what to do with it. I was in so much pain based on my shame that some days I couldn't even put a sentence together. So continuing to drink through that was really the only solution I had. You know, I had no coping skills for anything other than drinking. I started drinking when I was 9. I had no coping skills for anything other than drinking. And so I used it. And I used it, and I used it, and I used it beyond the point where it was helpful. And I used it to the point where I couldn't quit even when I wanted to quit. I couldn't back off. You know, there was just no moderation for me. And today I know that what was happening to me was physical. Today I know that. Today I know. It tells me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that people of my kind, we experience a phenomenon of craving that is triggered once we put alcohol into our bodies, and it renders us completely unable to control the amount that we take. That was happening to me every single day, and I didn't understand it, and I didn't know what was going on, and I thought that it was just happening to me because I was bad, and I was dirty, and I was doing bad things, and that this was my punishment. And I wasn't taken to church, and I wasn't raised with any necessary or any concrete idea of God, really. But somehow I knew that God, that there was a God and that he hated me. I knew that there was a God out there, and there was a set of standards that I was never taught, but I wasn't living up to them. And I was absolutely certain that if I ever ran into God, I was going to have to try to hide. And I didn't know how that was going to happen, but I knew that God didn't want anything to do with me. If there was a God, and I was pretty sure that there was, and I have no idea where that came from. Actually, I was talking to my sponsor about 6 months ago, and she and I, we were having a conversation. I had gone to Akron. My family still lives up in that area, and I had taken my husband up. He'd never been to Dr. Bob's house or any of that stuff up there, and I got sober around all that. I mean, I was sitting on the front steps of Dr. Bob's house before a meeting, pouting because they didn't take me into the bad neighborhood to get the newcomer. You know, they'd leave me on Dr. Bob's porch thinking that I was safe there while they would run off and get the newcomer. And, you know, I would just sit there and pout. I had no frame of reference for the fact that I was on Dr. Bob's porch, you know. It was just this house that they thought was safe for some reason, like it had some, you know, vortex around it or something. but it was around the holidays, actually. My husband and I, we had gone up. He had just gotten home from Afghanistan, and we were visiting my family for a couple of days around the holidays. And I was sitting and I was talking with my sponsor. And my sponsor lives in Akron. And she's the archivist for Akron Area Intergroup and has been for 17 years. And we were sitting there and we were just talking about various things. And I was telling her, she said, you know, what was one of your favorite things that you used to do when you were a little kid? And I said, I used to roller skate. I used to roller skate all the time. And she said, well, where would you roller skate? And it just, I mean, it hit me. And I said, oh, my gosh. There was a church that was up the hill, probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 houses up the hill from my house. And it was at the top of the hill, and it had a flat parking lot with, like, a second level so we could build ramps and stuff. And we used to go up there, and we would roller skate all the time when I was this little kid, you know. And we would roller skate up there, and one of the gals at the church, they had this Wednesday night thing for kids. And she came out during the summer, and she said, you know, why don't you guys come in and have cookies and punch and spend a little bit of time with us? And so on Wednesday nights, we would go into this church, and we would do we would do kids' crafts and that kind of stuff. And that's where I got this notion that there was a God, and I had completely forgotten about that. And so I'm talking about this as it's kind of unraveling, you know, 21 and a half years or almost 22 years sober, and I'm just finally putting these pieces together. And she said, well, so they were really nice to you, and I said they were, and she said, so why is it that you had such a bias against God and organized religion? And I said, you know, in my 9-year-old head, I thought that they should have figured out what was going on in my house and they should have come down and saved me. And I never knew that. But it hit me at 22 years sober that that's where that crap came from. And I never knew that. I knew that I had it. I knew that I had the bias. I knew that I had these weird ideas about God that weren't true. But I didn't know where they had come from because, you know what, sometimes the origin of it isn't important. Just the fact that I got it and I got to do something with it and overcome it is. So, anyway, where was I in my story? Anyway, so 6 to 9 months prior to me getting sober, I was drinking every day. I was an absolute wreck. I had so much, you know, shame, guilt, and remorse. I mean, talk about the four horsemen out of the big book. Oh, my God, they chased me every morning. And I had to, you know, I had to drink my way sober so that I could go to school. And I was doing all of these other things, and I was exhausted. I was exhausted. A lot of you live double lives, and I lived a double life, and it's exhausting to have to work that hard just to get through a day so that this group didn't find out what you were doing with this group and this group. You know, it was just a lot of work. And my parents had divorced, and, you know, when I was 12 and my sister was 14, we went to my mom and we said, look, you know, can you get us out of here? I mean, honestly, we're kids, and we can't leave without you. My sister had tried. She had run away, and they kept, you know, picking her up, putting her in juvie jail and bringing her home. And my dad was such a violent alcoholic, and we were just tired of getting beat, and we said, can you please just get us out of here? And so we left, and what she knew that we didn't know is that we were going to move into abject poverty. She knew that. She knew what was waiting for us. That was one of the reasons why we were still there, you know. But we moved out, and, I mean, everything fell apart. She got 2 jobs. She got real busy trying to support us, keep a roof over our head, keep groceries on our table. You know, and I was drinking like a fish, and my sister did dry drugs, like, you know, whatever she had. You know, she loved to smoke pot and do cocaine and do all those other things, and I didn't. I just wasn't interested. I drank. And you know, I guess that, you know, that there's no conflict of interest in our house then, you know. I didn't get into her stash, she didn't get into mine, we were good. But we were just completely off the chain, and my mom is working her tail off to try to make things happen for us. And so, you know, that was kind of some of the stuff that was going on. And my mom went out of town for a weekend when I was a sophomore in high school, when I was 15 years old. She went out of town with a boyfriend. She got a man who was nice to her and did things like paid for dinner when they went out and things like that, and was, you know, would compliment her instead of tear her down and things, something that she had never experienced because she was raised by an alcoholic, married one, and she was raising 2. Who knew? And so she went out of town, and my sister and I decided instead of crossing the tracks and going to that dark little house on the wrong side that we were going to stay home. Somehow we thought that we would be safer at home. But we still called those people and asked them to bring over the things that we needed, and they came. And it was a really ugly scene that night. My mom came home. She got in a fight with that boyfriend. She came home at 1:16 a.m. And the only reason I know that is there was a red digital clock sitting right there. And I came too, and I'd been in a drunken stupor since 8 p.m. I had been physically unable to move. I don't remember much of it, although I was in and out. And I was sitting there in all of my bodily fluids, and I was so incredibly sick I couldn't move. And that's what she walked in on. And up to that point, she did not know that I was drinking, that my sister was doing drugs. She just didn't know. she was so busy trying to feed us and keep shelter over us that she just didn't know. And there was a part of her that couldn't know. She was, alcoholism had beat her down so much that the idea that she was raising an alcoholic, she didn't have anywhere in her brain to put that information. You know, she had the uncanny ability to believe that things were the way she believed them to be rather than the way she saw them to be. You know, it's just this amazing ability that folks who go to Al-Anon have. It's impressive. Anyway, so all of that happened. My two worlds collided. And the only way I knew how to get out of this jam was to go to treatment. Now, I had heard about treatment because they were teaching people about alcoholism in school. I was actually part of Teen Institute, so with a hangover, I was going to elementary schools teaching elementary kids about the family dynamics of the disease of alcoholism and telling my sorry tale. But I was so incredibly hungover and just couldn't wait to get out of there so that I could get another drink myself. And so I knew that alcoholism was out there. I had no idea that I had it. I mean, it didn't make any sense to me. If you want to look at an alcoholic, look at my dad. Don't look at me. But anyway, the only way I knew how to get out of this jam, because what happened was when she came home and caught me and things fell apart and things got crazy and I was abusive and she was hurt and it was just this ugly thing, she called the police. I mean, how dare she? But she called the police, and so all of a sudden everybody knew. And these people in the dark little house on the wrong side of the tracks who were not great people, they all of a sudden, they were getting arrested and they were getting charged for a myriad of things, and all of them had to do with the fact that we had gotten busted because they had been supplying us with alcohol and drugs, and there had been things going on in that house that were, you know, unspeakable, and so they were getting in trouble for these things, and I needed to get out of town. And the only way that I knew how to get out of town at that point was to say that I was alcoholic, so they'd ship me off to treatment. And they did, but they gave me 2 weeks before I had to go to treatment because I told them I had some affairs to get in order. Now, I'm not sure what affairs a 15-year-old has to get in order, but I had affairs to get in order, and I didn't want to go right away. And so I was home for 2 weeks. I drank every single day because I had to. And the Saturday after Thanksgiving, I had been trying to commit suicide for a couple of days. But I didn't want to shoot. I didn't own a gun. We didn't have a garage. We didn't have a gas stove. I mean, you know, I had to rule out all of these ways of committing suicide. And I just figured if I could figure out a way to not pass out, I was drinking so much anyway that maybe I could just drink myself to death. And so I was trying to do that. And it just didn't work. And I came to in downtown Cleveland at an inpatient treatment facility. I came to 3 days after I got there. And while I was there for those first 3 days, I had told them the truth. Now, I had no intention of telling them the truth, you see. When they asked me, how much do you drink, I knew to say, well, a couple, but maybe on weekends I do a little more than I ought to. You know, and I had my story in place because I also didn't want them to really focus too much on how much I drank because I really didn't believe that I was an alcoholic. I just needed a few weeks off the street. So I was just going to go in. My plan was to go in for a 10-day evaluation period. They would see that clearly my father was the issue, and the fact that I was raised in alcoholism was the issue, and that they would just let me come home. And by that time, after 10 days, surely the bad people would be in jail, people would forget they were mad at me, and I could go on with my life. It sounds like a 15-year-old, huh? Well, that didn't happen at all because I had gotten completely honest, and so they decided they were going to keep me for as long as insurance would allow. And I was there for 40 days. And I was there for 10 days, and I had gone down to the treatment unit, and they called a code. And all the counselors, the male counselors, started loosening their ties and rolling up their sleeves and going up to the evaluation unit where I just come from. And I stopped one. I said, what's going on? And they said, oh, your sister's here. Because it seems that I got honest not only about my drinking but about her drug use. And so they called my mom and said, you got another one. You might want to bring her in. So my sister and I, we went to treatment together. That was very ugly. When she came down 10 days later, you know, I went up. I hadn't seen her in a long time. She was my best friend. And I said, I'm so glad you're here. And she said, don't go to sleep. I said, Roger that. So I'm wide awake for the last 20 days of my treatment. I get out of there. When I'm leaving, my sister grabs me and she says, you do not relapse until I get out of here. Are we clear? And I said, yes. She said, you go see our people. You get my stuff. You get yourself a bottle, but you wait. You will not be out there partying while you have me locked up in this place. And I said, okay. Because, you know, when I was in treatment, I wasn't interested in getting sober. I wasn't really interested in learning that much. I was interested in a little bit of a break. I was really tired, so I wanted to sleep a lot. And I just wanted to recoup and get back out there. And that was my plan. My sister got out of treatment 20 days later. I had my stuff. I had her stuff. We were ready to go. She got home, and I was so excited she was home because I had been not drinking for 10 days waiting on her to get out of treatment. And I don't, you know, for any of you who have had forced periods of sobriety when you're a real alcoholic, they suck. And so I had forced sobriety for 10 days. She got out, and I came, you know, I was like, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad, you know, let's go. I'm ready, you know, I'd been ready to drink. I mean, I'd been sober since, you know, what, the Saturday after Thanksgiving. I mean, that was several months. And she said, you know, those last few days of treatment, they called it a spiritual experience. And so I think we ought to go to AA. And I said, AA, you didn't even drink. And she said, I know. They said NA's bad, so I need to go to AA. So we have to go to AA meetings. And I said, I'm not going to AA meetings. I have a bottle under the floorboards upstairs. And she said, no. She said, we got to give this a go. She said, if it doesn't work, then we'll relapse. And I said, well, how long do we have to try this? And she said, I don't know. Let's just go. And I was like, oh, for the love of God. So off we go to AA meetings. And my mom would drop us off 15 minutes before they were to start. We'd stand in the parking lot. We would bum cigarettes from people. Now, I didn't smoke until I got sober. But you all smoke, so, you know, and I didn't drink coffee either. But we would bum cigarettes. We'd stand outside. We'd smoke long enough to be late getting into the meeting. We would go into the meeting. We would make sure that we sat in the back. We would screech our chairs when we pulled them in and out from the table. We would get up and refill our coffee several times, whether it was a speaker. Well, most meetings up there are speaker meetings. But we'd get up and refill our coffee several times. We would talk to people. We would write notes. We would try to get dates with the really sick men who thought newcomer adolescents were cute. And we were an absolute disruption to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And finally, they had had enough. And Max Shadburn, who to me at the time was about 8 foot tall and had shoulders this broad and had been sober since Christ was a child, he stood in front. Now, I would always get out of the meeting before the Lord's Prayer because I didn't know the words. And you weren't going to pull my punk card like that. So I always left before the Lord's Prayer because I was embarrassed by that. And so I went to leave this meeting this one night. My sister and I were sneaking out, and he got up and he stood in front of the door. He said, "Get in the circle." Okay, and we got in the circle, and so we stayed till the end of the meeting. As soon as the prayer was done, I went to bolt out of the door, and there he was again. And he said, "Are you an alcoholic?" Now, people had been telling me I was an alcoholic. I had a clinical diagnosis as an alcoholic, or chemically dependent, I think they were beginning to call it in those days. But nobody had asked me if I was alcoholic. And I said, I don't know. And he said, "Can you control your drinking?" And I said, "I don't know. I mean, I'd never tried. You know, cap was off the bottle, out of the neck. When it was gone or I was passed out, that's when I was done. You know, I'd never tried to control my drinking. I mean, the whole idea of that was really foreign to me." And he said, "Well, here's $5. Go find out. But if it doesn't work, you get back here. If it does, I never want to see you again." I was like, all right. So I went and got my sister, and I was like, "Go get your $5. We are out of here." It seemed reasonable to me. So her disease had been working on her from the inside. I'd been working on her from the outside. March 14th, 1987, my sister and I go out, and we relapse. And I can tell you this, I was going to have 3 shots and 2 beers. To me, that was moderate drinking. And I was going to stop right there. I was going to get a little bit of a buzz on. I was going to ride it out. I was going to get a little bit of that relief that I remembered from the first time that I drank, because I hadn't had any relief for several months. I had been alcohol-free and absolutely miserable because that parade was nonstop in my head. I felt like dying every single day because there was no relief, there was no program, there was no God for me. I wasn't doing anything but not drinking. And there is no more miserable place for a real alcoholic to be than to be not drinking without a program. And that's what I had been. And so I was going to have 3 shots, 2 beers. It was going to take the edge off, and I was going to be good. And I had 3 shots and 2 beers, and you know what? That hit my system. It didn't take long at all. And I felt a little bit of that edge come off, and I thought, I'm controlling my drinking. This is good. I am controlling my drink. I'm not going to have anything else tonight. I'm going to be good. And then I thought, I mean, one more shot. What could that really hurt? I mean, honestly, one more shot. So I had one more shot, and then I thought, maybe just a little bit more beer to rinse that down. I mean, really. I'm not drunk. I'm not oblivion. I'm not with those people in that place. Nothing bad's happening. I'm good. And then I thought, well, maybe just one more shot. You know, I'm still feeling good. There's nothing bad happening around me. And one more beer and one more shot and one more beer and one more shot. And guess where I ended up? Oblivion and at that house on the wrong side of the tracks again. And I came to the next morning. I literally crawled to the next morning. And I just looked in the mirror and I started to cry. And I thought, my God, I am young. I am otherwise healthy. And I could live like this for a very long time. And I thought, I can't. I can't continue to do this. I can't do this every single day. And I knew that when I was drinking before I went to treatment, that this is the way I lived every single day, and I was unwilling to do it like this anymore. And I remembered what Max Shadburn had said when he threw me out of AA. That's how I told the story. I was thrown out of AA. But he said, if it didn't work, you get back here. And I heard his voice say, if it doesn't work, you get back here. And so that night I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went in on time, not early, but on time. I sat in the middle. I did not refill my coffee. I got in the circle at the end for the prayer. Luckily, in the late 80s, we had really big hair. Now, you think I have a lot of hair now. You ought to have seen when I elevated it in the 80s. And we would build it up real high, and we would hairspray it all in place. So when you bowed your head down, there was like a hinge right here, and the whole thing would kind of fall down. And it would cover your face. And so I was able to get in that circle and bow my head, and my hair would come down, and it would cover me. And nobody knew. I didn't know the words to the Lord's Prayer. And then I went to leave that meeting, and Max Shadburn was standing in front of that door again. And he said, how you doing? I said, just fine. He said, mm-hmm. Did you get a sponsor yet? And I said, no. And he said, you're not leaving here until you get a sponsor. And now, I had been around long enough to know that I had to ask women to be my sponsor. And I didn't like people, and I particularly didn't care for women much. And so I went up to every woman in that room, and I said, I have to have a sponsor before Mac will let me leave. What do you think? And every one of them said, no. No. Oh, no. Oh, mm-mm. And I was thinking, what happened to this? You know, if somebody asks you to do something in AA, you do it. And, you know, nobody would say. And so I went to leave the room, and Max still standing at the door, and he said, did you get a sponsor? And I said, no one in here will sponsor me. He said, that's a lie. And I said, I'm not asking her. He said, oh, yes, you are. I'd asked every woman in that room but the one that I was supposed to ask, because they had a group conscience. So they'd had a group conscience, and they decided that if we came back after Mac had thrown, it was Mac's job to throw us out, and it was Jane's job to sponsor us if we popped back in. And I wanted nothing to do with Jane, because she too had been sober since Christ was a child. She was 73 years old. She had white hair. She smoked cigarettes on those long extender things. And when she would pull up to the back door in the car of random newcomers, the rest of the newcomers would scurry car side with a seat with a tall back on it, and they would help her out of the car into the high back chair, and they would carry her down the stairs into the meeting room like the Pope going through the plaza. And then she would sit in the front of the room, Mac would sit in the back of the room, and they would fight about what page something was on in the big book and what the real intention of Bill Wilson was when he wrote the 12 and 12. And I hated them both equally. So I had absolutely no intention of asking Jane to be my sponsor. But Mac wouldn't let me leave the room. And so I walked over to Jane, and I was absolutely terrified, just shaking in my boots. And I said, "Will you sponsor me?" And she looked up at me, and she said, "Why should I?" Now, what I had to say...
I'm really impressed.
I can stay sober and I don't know how. And she said, "Well, there'll be things I will be expecting you to do." And I was like, "Yes, ma'am." Now, I was raised in Ohio. We don't say yes, ma'am. I mean, I was taught manners when I moved to the South. But I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she gave me the list. You know the sponsor list that you get? You're going to call me every day. You're going to read such and such pages. You're going to do these things. I got in my sponsor list. And instead of telling her where to shove her sponsor list, I said, "Yes, ma'am." And I left the meeting. And the next day, I called her. And I didn't have anything to say to her. I said, "This is Deb from the meeting." She goes, "I know exactly who you are." I said, "Well, you told me to call." And she said, "Mm-hmm. I didn't think you would." And I said, "Yes, ma'am. Well, here I am." She said, "You'll be going to a meeting tonight." And I said, "No, ma'am. I have homework, and I have this, and I have that." And she said, "You'll be going to a meeting tonight. I'll speak with you in the morning." And at 7 o'clock every single night, there was an enormous old Ford LTD or some such vehicle sitting in my driveway. They were the old kind of cars you had to start turning about 3 blocks back. And then eventually they'd kind of swoop their way into a position. And then when they turned them off, they would just kind of go like this. There was one of those kind of cars sitting in my driveway every single night at 7 o'clock with some old timer who had, 15, 20, 30 years of sobriety, smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee with some newcomer, country western music playing on the radio, telling bad jokes. And they would sit in my driveway and they would wait. And I would stand on my front porch like this. And I would stare at that car and I would say, "I'm not getting in there. I went to a meeting yesterday. I don't know why I have to go to so many meetings. I'm fine. I haven't had anything to drink in 6 days. I'm not sure what these people expect of me, but I'm fine." I would have these conversations. The head of a newcomer is a scary place. And I would have these conversations in my head. And I'm like, "And who does this woman think she is running my life like this? I'm doing just fine without her. I don't know why. I don't even know these old men. Why am I supposed to get in a car with people I don't know?" And it wasn't just going to the meeting, but after I would finally get in the car, then they'd take me to the meeting, and then they wouldn't take me home. They'd take me to the damn donut shop. You know, and at the donut shop, you know, they'd buy me a donut, a cup of coffee, and because I wasn't allowed to talk at meetings, ever. Jane said, "Look, meetings are where we talk about the solution. You got no idea what that is, and you won't be spreading your disease. Keep your mouth shut." So anyway, we would go to the donut shop, and at the donut shop, I was allowed to ask questions. And what those men did for me was this. They shared with me their intimate stories of how their lives were put back together, these amazing stories of restoration. They would share with me about the fact that they got to go to their daughter's house for Sunday dinner when they hadn't been welcome in their daughter's house for 20 years. They would tell me about celebrating grandchildren's birthdays. They would tell me these amazing stories, and I would ask them how all that happened. And what they would do was the skeleton of Alcoholics Anonymous came into view. You know, each step was a piece on this straw man that they were drawing for me. And so I had this, I built this basic idea of what recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous could be. And then as I worked the steps with the direction of lots of sponsors, as I worked the steps and applied those principles to my own life, I got to put the meat on the bones. And I got to recover from the disease of alcoholism, because what they gave me was enough to bring about the spiritual experience necessary and vital for my ongoing recovery. And it was really this amazing gift of overwhelming love. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous decided that if I came back, that they were uniquely qualified to save my life. Therefore, it was their responsibility to do so. And that's why I know, standing here tonight, that I am uniquely qualified to save the lives of other alcoholics. And therefore, it is my responsibility to do so. I'm sorry that I don't have more time to tell you about some of the ways that God has worked in my life today. I've just chattered a little bit too much. What I can do is tell you this. I was able to go ahead and graduate from high school. I got to graduate from college. I got to graduate from graduate school, and I have a master's degree. Today, I do work that I love. I'm finally married to a man I adore and who adores me. He's a major in the United States Marine Corps. We've just been through 2 years of back-to-back war deployments where he lost an entire platoon worth of men out of the field of battle. He buried 20. And, you know, when he would call me from Afghanistan, because he and I put God first and we entered into a faith group that we both believed in and we were both accepted into the church and I became a Christian and all of these wonderful things came together before we got married. When he would call me from Afghanistan, I was able to say to him things like, "How can I pray for you today so that you can be more successful?" And he would say things to me like, "Will you pray to God that I have more courage today than I had yesterday? Because I'm tired of looking at dead kids and I'm scared that I'm not a strong enough leader." And I'd say, "Honey, I can do that for you." Because we got our spiritual language put in place before we took the vows of marriage. This time we did it in the right order. And I can tell you that man came home, he pinned on a bronze star for his leadership and service. And I just think that he probably hung the moon. And I sponsor a lot of girls. And I'm on the steering committee for the Alano Club, even though I hate club politics. Somebody's got to do it. And my home group is the Thursday night Big Book Workshop in Yucca Valley at the Alano Club. Anytime you're up there visiting, anytime you just get tired of, I don't know, beauty and flowers and want to come up and look at dirt, come on up and visit. We would love to have you. Anytime that you hear of somebody who lives up there and they need the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope that you track me down. We do good work up there. We're working every day on saving the lives of other alcoholics. I'm on my knees in prayer every morning because I don't know who God's going to put in my life. And if I'm not connected with him, I won't have their answers. Because the answers that you need come from God. They just come through me when my house is in order. Thank you so much for having me. And Andy, thank you for sharing. I called you the wrong name earlier, and I apologize for that. But your 10-minute story absolutely put me in the right place tonight. Thank you all very much. Yeah.